AI has changed that in the sense that it's we need power and we need power now, and it's substantial amounts of power.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 108, episode 108 of the Flux Capacitor. I've been chatting with industry business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society, and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector. The conversation today is about artificial intelligence, AI, and the electricity business. My guest on the podcast today is
Shaz Marwat, RBC, RBC Economics and Thought Leadership Group, covering all things energy related as the energy policy lead.
Shaz is the lead author of the RBC Climate Institute's report, Power Struggle, How AI is Challenging Canada's Electricity Grid. He joins me for a conversation about AI's rapid power demand growth, some differences between regions in the country, and the economic impact of data centers. We also chat about the need for strategic policies to leverage AI in data centers and the potential role that carbon capture can play and the importance of energy security. We close the conversation with Shaz's very timely and topical recommendation for a book to add to the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Here is my conversation with Shaz Marwat, recorded on Zoom in early February 2025. Shaz, welcome to the podcast. I think we're going to talk AI today.
I think we are going to talk AI today. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. So we'll put a link to the report. We'll talk about a bunch of things, but principally, you know, we're going to be chatting about this report that has just come out, Power Struggle, How AI is Challenging Canada's Electricity Grid. So on the show page, we'll have a link to that. But maybe begin before we get to that. So this is part of the Climate Institute at RBC. I know I've had people on previously, like John Stackhouse has been on before, but can you just give the listener a reminder, like what is the Climate Institute and why is RBC in this business?
Yeah, it's a good question, one that comes up quite frequently. I'd say, you know, we sit within RBC Economics and Thought Leadership, okay. The group which sits within the office of the CEO. And I think the mandate as that unit is to at times to go beyond the traditional economics of what is happening day to day, quarter to quarter, mm-hmm. Poll after poll, jobs number, to kind of think a bit more strategically long term. What does Canada need to do to position itself for prosperity? Obviously, right. RBC is the largest bank in Canada. So if Canada is doing well, RBC will do well. Mm-hmm. And it was about 2021 where obviously increasingly, the world was shifting towards being a bit more mindful of climate issues, ESG in particular. Mm-hmm. And so the Institute felt that, you know, there were certain things that were hindering Canada's progress on climate. And what can we do to instill that action to unlock those barriers? And it felt it needed a foundational part within RBC Economics and Thought Leadership, and that became the Climate Action Institute. And so there's five of us. Uh-huh. Maya Tarong-Regan heads up the group, reporting into John Stackhouse. And we look at all things climate-oriented in Canada.
Yeah, and a couple of weeks ago, you released your Climate Action 2025 report. I was there in Toronto for that. It was a fun event. But I thought it was really interesting that that your idea of the year that electricity may hold the key, or why electricity holds the key for Canada's climate transformation. Coming from Electricity Canada, love to hear that. Love to hear that kind of the understanding, the recognition of that critical role that electricity is going to play. But you're, one of the folks, I guess the principal author of the specific report on AI. So why don't we dig down into that one? I found it interesting that the title is How AI is Challenging Canada's Electricity Grid. So maybe the first question is, how is AI challenging Canada's electricity grid?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think if you look at the numbers right now, it doesn't look like it. I think maybe to hit to both points of your question. I'm actually quite new to electricity. My background originally was in oil and gas, and then I was a traditional equity strategist, so I was looking at equities, but not really specific to anything. We kind of thought, what were the big mandates that were coming? And so I think AI and electricity are, electricity is kind of cool again. Like, this is my first time getting into it, but I think that to the average layman, if you will, electricity is just kind of boring, right? You plug in something, you turn on a switch, and there it is, and you expect it always to be there. And you don't get a lot of load growth. But as the climate topic progressed, we always had this question of, do we have enough electricity? And I think it really always situated towards electric vehicles at the time. We're going to have electrification. We're going to fuel switch away to what we can electrify as that low-hanging fruit. But we always thought that it was going to take time. Like, it takes, 7 to 10 years for an individual to flip over their car. And so everything was considered a slow burn. And AI has changed that in the sense that we need power, and we need power now, and it's substantial amounts of power. And so I think for us as an institute, it's kind of cool in two ways. One, there is the electricity angle to it, which is very much a part of, the Climate Institute, if you will. But then you have this AI thing, which extends way beyond just power and what can it do to productivity, especially at a time where Canada has lagging productivity, and whether that's a strategic economic importance to us. So I think it's really this cross of two things coming together. One was maybe has always been cool in technology, and then electricity kind of becoming this increasingly discussed topic. And how it's critically important. A lot of times, I think we think of the low-hanging fruit and dismiss that that's still a bit challenging at times. I guess it's less challenging than trying to decarbonize other sectors, and then putting all that together at a time critically now, when we need it. We're in the last part of the decade of getting to where we need to for either 2030, but also building the momentum for net zero in 2050.
I was at a presentation put on by one of the Department of Energy labs in the States, specifically on this topic about what the growth may look like in this space. And they were showing, and this is based upon their projection of the purchase of chips. Moving forward, that the demand, the percentage of demand for electricity to power data centers was going to go from somewhere south of 2% to over 10% in 5 years. And that's on the one hand, that's a head scratcher in terms of how do we get from here to there. But on the other hand, they had a statistic, and the same one that's in your report, that a Google search versus ChatGPT consumes 10 times more electricity. And yeah, I guess as that comes on, that massive increase is going to be driving some, I guess, some interesting developments. We're going to have a lot of people wanting to set up data centers. I know they're already knocking on people's doors now, but what does that start to look like from your perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a very well traveled with statistic, the 10x on the ChatGPT query. Very similar when if you do a Google query with AI. I think it gets really cool when you look at some of the non-generative text type of applications. So, for instance, my wife had showed me a song that her brother had made about our cats, basically, and just had uploaded photos of these cats. And AI was able to dictate what it thought these cats could do. And it made a song about it. It was actually kind of ridiculous. You know, when you look at stuff like that, that's when you're getting into the thousands times power implications. And so,
Right.
you know, there was an academic study that looked at like a 30-frame, 30-second video made from, you know, AI or whatever. It could actually take as much power to charge an EV almost 10 kilometers. Like, it's just
Wow.
truly,
Yeah.
truly astronomical. And again, it comes down to this, you know, I have a 1-year-old. I can only imagine it's only out of time until he picks up his first, you know, iPad or whatever, starts playing with it. But if this guy starts making, you know, videos on Chat GPT or whatever, it's truly, I think from the power spectrum, that's when it gets to be, you know, a bit of a head scratcher. I think, you know, there was a Electricity Council of Canada report that had projected our electricity needs would double, maybe triple from what they are today relative to 2050. And, you know, that report, like, as they'll admit, didn't really include this concept of AI. So it seems like it's turning into a double to triple, almost boundless in terms of what the, you know, of what the requirements are. And it really depends on how we integrate the technology. We tend to binge on technology as humans, and view things as being limitless. And that's the one that's a bit different. Totally what you had cited in the report. In the report at the time, you know, we had found 15 gigawatts of data center projects in queue. I would believe after Kevin O'Leary's announcement and just, you know, with the progression of time, that number might look like 25 gigawatts. Not necessarily in queue, but as expressed interest. And so, you know, 25 gigawatts. I mean, 15 gigawatts is basically 7 out of every 10 homes in Canada. 25 gigawatts, that's like Houston plus Miami plus Toronto plus, like, these are mega cities combined in terms of what their power capacity is. And so that's when it gets to be a bit of a, you know, maybe pause for concern in terms of do we have the resources for all this?
So maybe let's chat a little bit about that, about the resources. And you know, I think you, what was that section in your report, a new trading chip, where, you know, you kind of get into this. Why don't you maybe unpack that a little bit for the listener?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's, you know, the report happened before, sorry, it was published before January 20th. Obviously, the world turned on January the 20th. It's now February the 4th. I guess you could argue that post February the 1st, the world has turned a bit as well. And so there is increasingly, I think two ways that we kind of looked at it. Firstly, we didn't want to come out, you know, in an unobjective manner and start to dictate what was strategic and what was not strategic. So in the report, we tried to look at, you know, what is the economic value that comes from traditional industries, and, you know, what is the, not only the power requirement, maybe even the emissions cost associated with it. And so we did that with data centers. And, you know, data centers, from the analysis that we did, we compared the GDP impact per unit of CO2 emissions for a data center relative to traditional industries like manufacturing, oil and gas, utilities. And from a GDP standpoint, you know, data centers come out on top. From a job standpoint, however, they rank amongst the worst. And it's just one of those things where the average data center probably only employs 75 people. Directly, indirectly, maybe 250 to 300. So it's limited from a job standpoint. But again, that's not how we think of AI. It's really this capacity to unlock and enhance productivity, which has so many downstream applications. And so it's about how can we take that compute power and use it more in a more targeted approach. I think for Canada, obviously, that's a good story in and of itself. I think what was interesting was, you know, while I was writing the report, there was a news article had come out that there was a Chinese ship that had purposely dropped its anchor, and as a result of that, cut a subsea data cable, I believe, in the North Atlantic. And so, you know, it kind of then started to make you question what Sam Altman is talking about when he's trying to pitch this administration so aggressively about turning North America into a data fortress, in the sense that you have this compute capacity, maybe you have sensitive files, but as we migrate from a traditional economy to a data-centered economy, which was already happening before AI, you know, how can we ensure that all of that data is inherently safe? Well, yeah, if there's subsea data cables that could be cut at any point in time, it would make you think maybe we need to make sure that all of this data lives locally within within North America. And then from Canada, obviously, it starts to look like we have a lot of advantages. We have a cold climate.
Yep.
We have clean technology, which is increasingly important to big tech. And we have a close proximity to the U.S. Obviously, the amount of fiber and latency becomes of an issue there. But more often than not, like, you know, the speed at which the data would travel from Canada to the U.S. would be much quicker than it would be, let's say, from, you know, U.S. to Northern Europe. And obviously, the longer it takes for data to travel, the more subject it is to infiltration and cyber theft and cybersecurity and whatnot. So it starts to take on a bit of a protectionist tinge. I think for Canada, it's an interesting question now, because historically we've had greater data privacy laws in Canada than they've had in the U.S. And so as a result, we've said, you know, certain financial records, medical records have to be kept within Canada. I don't know if Mr. Donald Trump comes in and starts to say that, you know, we want to be able to host some of your data. You know, we don't want you to be so protectionist on your data. You know, that could be a risk for Canada. But at the same time, it could go the other way too. I mean, America could turn more protectionist with its data and follow Canada's path as well. And so we have a USMCA renegotiation to occur. You know, this concept of digital trade, Chapter 19, was one of the important parts of the first renegotiation of NAFTA. So, like, it's I don't know if it's high on Mr. Trump's list relative to the border and fentanyl and national defense and whatnot, but definitely seems like over a 4-year period that you know, Canada does again have some opportunities and ways that it can, you know, go to America and say, you know, we have things that you may need. This is a valuable trading relationship. So we called it a new trading chip, if you will.
Well, and you know, to your point, if one looks at the entourage around the new president, there are a lot of people in the tech sector. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think Chapter 19 is going to be something that will be looked at most definitely.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point with Elon seeing to be around everywhere.
That's right.
You know, just, you know, about the importance of that. And but not only just even the integration and the use of AI, obviously, not only to streamline operations, not only from within the government, but across business.
Yeah. Listen, there was something that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that I mean, we all know it's true. We hear about it. But I'm wondering if you have any kind of insights in terms of the why. And that is, there is a great deal of interest by people that are in the tech sector for clean energy. I'm just wondering what is, if you've got a sense, you know, having looked at this, what the driver is of that. Is this seen as simply, you know, a question of this is virtuous and we want to appear to be virtuous, or do people actually see this is good business, or are they one and the same?
It's a good question. You know, I might actually be interested to hear what you have to say actually as well on the topic, but I can kind of provide my views. I think when we were doing the report, it was helpful to wear the different hats that the provinces tend to wear when they view their resource in and around electricity. And again, I'm not here to say one method is correct or one method is incorrect. You know, with what data centers are looking for, ultimately looking for power, and they're looking for power, you know, today, if not yesterday. And so when you're looking at that amount of power, you know, multiple gigawatts potentially, for one data center campus, if you will, like it's hard to procure that from the renewable side. Obviously, you know, a 465 megawatt solar wind farm, the Traverse wind farm in Alberta, you know, we looked at the land use of that. It's the equivalent of three Stanley Parks, or, you know, eight Hyde Parks, or like seven Central Parks. It's a very large land use there. And so, you know, natural gas obviously seems to be what's becoming the clear winner, even when these big tech firms are procuring physical power. They're taking it from a natural gas site, and then they're offsetting it through RECs or whatnot. I mean, I think that in oneself is just a natural resource question. Do you have gas in your backyard or do you not? And then secondly, if you look to, you know, the intermittent nature of renewables is a bit problematic with data centers. Data centers need to run
Just
literally
a
like
bit. Yeah, just
99%
a
of the
bit
time.
problematic. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they need
And
or
then,
yeah, they need uptimes that are measured in the you know, the second or third decimal.
and so then to put, battery storage on
Yeah.
top of that, it becomes to get a bit costly. And then I think Quebec had probably the most interesting perspective in the sense that, they have a cap and trade system. So it's not just a function of their power, but also a function of how they view the emissions and what their targets are there under a cap and trade system. They can't just generate new emissions, if you will. And they've already made promises to, the switch towards electrification for other industrial uses. Other participants are kind of banking on that power to be there. And so again, these are all things that provinces need to take into consideration. It does seem that I think from our report, Alberta and Ontario are probably the two that are best situated to accept, if you will, this interest in data centers. Ontario, in the sense that most of the population is here, so the cost of fiber and the latency actually becomes a bit important as well, because we have just such a vast amount of individuals here. It would make sense to put data centers in around the population, but also because we do have that spare capacity on gas, which it seems the province is already headed towards during that period where we are refurbishing our nuclear. And then in Alberta, it's obviously natural gas is being viewed as an important part of their own transition. And at the same point in time, it's a meaningful incremental source of demand. If you look at these numbers, it's the equivalent of like an LNG train popping up in Alberta as to what the natural gas demand looks like. And then there's economic benefits from that as well. So it's again, it's it, I think we had a I think if you kind of looked at it from the different provinces' perspectives, actually helped try to get an understand as to where this thing is most likely going to go.
And I would imagine that the complexity of going through all of the approval processes, for example, and siting for nuclear and hydro makes it less appealing because it takes longer to get those kinds of projects pulled together and move forward. That probably comes into play in this as well, because as you said earlier, they're not looking for power in 15 years from now. They're looking for
Yeah,
power like yesterday.
that's a good point. And Francis, that's probably why we're starting to see the initial parts of that seed and investment go in from the big tech firms into nuclear across the group. Obviously, Three Mile Island's a bit different, being that the sense that if you restart that facility, you can get power like quite quickly because all that permitting and siting has already been done.
Yeah,
But
it's not a green field.
But 100% case to exactly what you just said, in terms of, okay, we're going to need this power in the 2030s, it kind of lines up with SMRs and where those are anticipated, expected to be. I guess, the big question mark is, what does battery technology do during that period of time? We didn't get to that in the report. But again, under a, not only a Trump administration, but a US that is con, you know, increasingly concerned about China and the supply chain and what that means for a lot of the minerals that go into these batteries. I think that increasingly is also becoming a bit of a concern. And nuclear is considered, at least in Canada, it's like a kind of like a homegrown fuel. Like we have the uranium here. Whether it's enriched or unenriched is a bit, it's a discussion on the technology that we use. But it does provide you a certain level of energy security that maybe certain other technologies may not.
Yeah, so friend-shoring, near-shoring may come into play in this conversation. Hey, one of the things that I ask folks that come on the podcast is about their journey. I'm always interested to get a sense of where people came from. And I make the joke. So here it is, Shaz, when you were a kid on the playground, is this what you always dreamed of doing, working in the economics and thought leadership at RBC?
I guess it depends on how far back we go. Actually, as a kid, I always wanted to be a pilot for the longest time. And yeah, I've been always been fascinated by planes and just the engineering, around it. And I didn't go down that path. Increasingly enough, I was originally from Pakistan, grew up in Saudi Arabia,
Oh,
and
wow.
I did my high school in the US, and I was there for 9/11, and I remember I had a friend kind of jokingly tell me, "You want to start flying planes? Yeah, that might not be in the cards for you right now," type thing. And so, it was one of those where, as I got older, interestingly enough, I found myself a bit more just situated and interested in oil. And my dad was a petroleum engineer, and I kind of originally had gone down that path. And so that's how I started off my career. Worked in Calgary, as a sell side oil and gas analyst, if you will. And as time kind of went by, these commodities, they have their boom and bust cycles. In 2016, oil really was down, and I kind of thought, do I need a new career or whatever? So then I switched to do something a bit more broad-based, if you will. And then, ESG kind of took off, and I kind of had a bit of a complementary skill set that I was already looking at carbon, and now we're trying to look at carbon. What does that mean for, the entire economy or investment portfolios, if you will? And so it's, I think, if you have a career in energy, and people have always said this, and I believe this to be true, that you can reinvent yourself numerous times. You can look at something different. In today's world, I think, like, critical minerals is almost basically part of energy. Like, everything seems to be morphing: old energy, new energy, energy to power, intelligence, artificial intelligence. It all really seems to be coming back down to this concept of intelligence and power and energy. So I think, yeah, to this day, I mean, if I could relive it, I probably wish I had been a bit more bold and went off and become a pilot, because it's 20 years later and I still love planes. But yeah, RBC is not a bad place to be, that's for sure.
Hey, when we talk about the challenges and the opportunities of AI, it occurs to me that this is very different from, like, even 5 years ago, when it was all about people who were doing Bitcoin mining, and they have a whole bunch of rigs that were doing their Bitcoin mining. We now have a new term, well, maybe not so new for you people like you who are in the know, but hyperscalers. So, I mean, this is the scope and scale of these operations is not at all what we were talking about even a couple of years ago, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, and again, I wish I could be in a room with Sam Altman, just even if it's for 30 minutes, just to hear him pitch, to hear the sorts of things he's discussing. I think I remember at one point, he was going on about, a data center is gonna one data center would require 1 gigawatt, and then went into, I can't remember if it was, a conversation having with a utility company or whatever, but then the number 5 gigawatts just kind of came about. And again, 100%, I remember looking at what Bitcoin mining was doing and the impact it had on Texas, because obviously so much Bitcoin mining had migrated to Texas. And I think the number at the time was like 5 gigawatts or 6 gigawatts, and it was basically like the equivalent of Houston. And I have brothers in Houston, and I'm just like, man, like, that's ridiculous. You think of all the industry that's based in Houston, from the oil and gas sector and everything. And firstly, it's a very large city. To think that, now the equivalent, now one data center campus, has the
That's
equivalent in
amazing.
it. It's amazing, right? And so I think there's a valid question when someone be like, what's the economic impact I'm getting out of this? Because I know what the GDP of Houston is. It's a pretty large number. And what necessarily am I getting from this data center side? I mean, we kind of look at it from an economic standpoint. The technology just seems to move so fast, and I don't know, what's the evolution of the speed of the chips. Of the chips, sorry. Obviously the world kind of turned a week ago with DeepSeek and what China was able to do. But I think it just throws out that question even more, in terms of what is actually going to be the end use of the power, how can we streamline it? But there's just so many different interesting nuggets. Like, we're doing some work right now on critical minerals, and apparently there's like a helium, there's a helium shortage. I mean, I
There's
thought
a
helium was just used
for balloons at
for
birthday
balloons, that's what I
parties.
thought. I was just like, what
So
possibly can we use
there's
helium
a
for?
helium shortage on right now.
Yeah, so apparently, for the US had a huge inventory of helium, which they had historically had used for powering airships. This was before planes were a thing as part of their strategic military and whatnot. And so, but over time, they were just taking out from the inventory, and then helium is actually produced when you produce natural gas, but under like vertical production, not shale production, because under shale production you basically blow up the rock through fracking, and helium is so light, it's literally lighter than air, it just all
Gone.
escapes. And so I kind of related it back to semiconductors and chips. Helium stays as a liquid even at minus 270 degrees Celsius. And so when they're coming up with these supercomputer chips, they can basically be cooled by this extra cold liquid, if you will, which it not only helps in terms of integrity of fabrication of the chip, but they need in the during the processing of the chip. And it's just, these little bits and pieces and nuggets that kind of come together from some, I guess you could call it extreme engineering, if you will. But I think that's the bit where, I kind of wish I knew someone in the tech space that could just talk to me about the evolution, because it just seems to move so fast in terms of what's able to be done.
I like that term, extreme engineering.
Yeah.
Listen, one of the other things that you touched on in your report was carbon capture, because, as you said, natural gas is likely to play an important increasing load on this. So what does the future look like for carbon capture in this space?
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised we haven't seen an announcement yet on that. I think, Francis, just you and I were at a conference just last week with a lot of interesting content. I think one of the takeaways for me was it seemed implicitly that if you were a believer in natural gas, you probably would have liked the things that you were hearing, because it seems like it still serves a functional need in providing reliable and affordable energy. And as part of that energy transition, at least in the near term, it seems like something that's provides resiliency to the grid. And I think one of the maybe pushbacks, if you will, has always been, well, what's effectively the life of the asset? You'll make a natural gas power plant or whatever to last 15 years or 20 years. It's got to be on for quite some time. And so I think you would think, and I could be wrong here, but I would think that kind of sets up nicely for someone who kind of needs power today, but then says, oh, but maybe at some point in time it now needs to be clean. Well, then I overlay that carbon capture on it, and there's nothing to say that announcement still can't come, but we do have leading companies in Canada that do the carbon capture. Obviously, Entropy as part of Advantage is probably the most prominent, if you will. And I think Alberta's come out and said that they've had conversations with big tech about carbon capture. Don't really know to what extent that is, but with nuclear getting so much attention, I would have thought carbon capture kind of probably would have had one or two of the same, especially in Canada, because we really do need some offtake agreements to get some of these technologies up and going, especially compared to what's happening in the US and Texas and whatnot. So, still to be determined, but the setup there, obviously, I'm sure economics is a big one, but it is an important piece of Canada's own ambition and journey to net zero, beyond just power, even within oil and gas and whatnot. So, as a climate enthusiast, would like to hopefully see that occur sooner rather than later.
What's it going to take? Is it economics right now? Do we need to be thinking about what kind of incentives to kind of move this from demonstration to full implementation? Because if we look at every other technology that we've got, the price begins to drop very quickly as the technology is adopted. I mean, just think of solar, for example, that every couple of years the cost of it is cut in half again. But we haven't hit the starting gate. And what do we need to kind of get to that to the start?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there are positives for Canada. Obviously, Carbon Engineering is the one that's most, known. Again, a Canadian company, Svante, a Canadian company. But the economics and the policies were just viewed as being better in the US, and so they deployed the technology in the US. Obviously, the US went the tax credit route where they guarantee revenue from the project effectively. So, you capture carbon and you're guaranteed, whether it be $85 a ton or $130 a ton, depending on exactly what you're doing. Where in Canada, we went the, de-risk the capital investment path, if you will. And it is meaningful. Like, don't get me wrong, at 62%, so 50% ITC from the feds, and then Alberta put on top of that a 12% ITC. It is meaningful in the sense of it, getting IRRs, above the threshold to be able to move forward. But ultimately, if you don't have a guaranteed revenue line, it's you're de-risking 62% of a project. I don't know if I'm gonna make any money off of it. And that's just the nature of where the country stands on the carbon tax, not only at a fuel level, even at it maybe in an industrial level. And so I think that's been the challenge. But at the same time, I kind of hope that that's the opportunity for a company within big tech who, let's be honest here, I think have like $250 billion of cash sitting on their balance sheet. They're spending $500 trillion over the last 2 years in hyperscale CapEx, right? So it's the money is there, and they
They've got
could.
plenty of space on their balance sheet.
Right. And so they could be that unicorn of offtake agreement that we've been waiting for. But again, I just, I'm sure they run their math and they know what they need from their energy portfolios and how they view that. And, maybe it's on the cards, but to this, I do think, I'm not sure what kind of discussions that they're in or whatever, but if Canada can help provide, that revenue certainty, obviously carbon contract for difference, as has been discussed quite a bit. If we can provide a little bit more there, maybe that's probably the missing piece to date to in order to get the technology deployed.
And until we get it deployed, we won't start to see the price, and
I mean that's the lesson we've learned from
the
China.
economics. Yeah, the
Has
economics.
been, China, I'm sure. I mean, obviously they, they subsidize and they, use a number of market distorting practices. But at the end of the day, I think they just look to, we need to ride this technology curve down as soon as we can, willing to take some losses here and there. And, on certain technologies it worked. I'm sure on certain technologies that we haven't heard of didn't work. But yeah, it's about just getting that capital deployed, riding that technology curve, and it just seems on carbon capture for that when America has the edge.
All right. Well, listen, let's talk of dollars and cents. $100 billion opportunity. What is the $100 billion opportunity? And what are
Yeah.
how did you come up with that?
Well, I guess I should be 170 because Mr. Lirio kind of blew me out of the water the minute this report came out. I think 3 days later he had his announcement on Wonder Valley. Yeah, that number is really a function of two things. I mean, Alberta has kind of gone out with that number as well, really about what the expressed interest of data centers that we're looking at could mean from from a from a dollar figure standpoint. Generally speaking, and it depends on who the hyperscaler is, but it's kind of been considered like, it's for every megawatt of power, it's $6 million to bring it on and on infrastructure investment and whatever. So I mean, with where the Canadian dollar is now, I mean, you kind of just multiply it by 10. So if you're looking at, 15 gigawatts, that basically turns into like, $150 million, give or take, if you will. And so then Mr. Wonderful came in with his $70 billion announcement. I think it's 7.5 gigawatts of potential there at the data campus. So it's already looking at like a number of 175, maybe even $200 billion, depending. Again, these are static linear numbers, depending on what happens with cost reductions and whatnot. And so they are very large numbers. The disclosure has actually been quite helpful from Amazon, if you will. Amazon obviously has made an announcement to invest, I believe, up to $21 billion, give or take, in data centers in the country. And they put out a pretty cool white paper where they kind of discussed about what the economic impact would be to those investments. And so you can do some basic modeling and whatnot to kind of, expect, okay, what kind of a GDP impact would those investments make, based on what's already been disclosed. But it's these are big numbers, but ultimately I think what's the most, what caught my eye more than anything, I think, is this. We have lagging productivity in Canada, and a good part of that is we Canadian businesses do not adopt AI to the same tune and pace that their American counterparts do. KPMG do a pretty good survey on that. And so one of the reasons is in Canada, we just have more small to medium enterprises relative to the US. So obviously, it's a bigger part of our economy. And obviously, small medium enterprise most likely doesn't have the capital, certainly isn't spending the type of R&D as you would of a blue chip company or whatever. So there are structural disadvantages to us maybe not deploying on AI. And so I think at the very least, if it in catalyzes other policymakers to think through, okay, how should we view this technology? I think a good offshoot of that would be like, well, then what kind of policy should we implement to then capture whatever part it is that we want to capture? Even if they say we only want to do half of this, fine. Well, then at least the half that we do want to capture, what kind of policies do we need to place? How can we get, businesses to adopt it more? How can we ensure that this compute power is going to research, to academics, to universities? Amazon had announced an agreement with the University of Alberta as part of that initial data center that they unveiled. And so I think all of these things are positives. It's even if you don't maybe chase the whole opportunity because you believe XYZ, for whatever reason it's too taxing, at the very least it's engaging minds to think strategically about what to do with the resource.
All right. You're not going to get away without giving me a book recommendation. So we assemble our book recommendations onto our Flux Capacitor book club list. So, Shaz, what book are you going to add to our reading list this week?
Yeah, so in a prior life, I was very much enthralled because my job required me to kind of chase every tweet Mr. Trump had put out back as part of Trump 1.0. And as part of that process, I got to know, I guess, through the internet, to know Mr. Robert Lighthizer quite intimately. And I know a lot of individuals in Canada, may have their personal opinions about Donald Trump, but when you get into some of the more foundational pieces as to what their view of trade is and how that's kind of unveiled, if you read Lighthizer's testimonies and his comments, you actually come out much more educated. You have a better understanding as what it is that America's trying to accomplish. He has a great book, No Trade is Free. Again, John had commented upon that at that conference. I do think anyone who wants to kind of take an alternative view to globalization, to nearshoring, to onshoring, I mean, irrespective, like I think that's just, has remained a foundational theme since 2016, since Brexit, if you will, only enhanced from the pandemic, where basically you couldn't even buy a car. The car is there sitting on a lot, you couldn't buy it because it was missing one chip, if you will, and to try to de-risk supply chain and stuff. So I think the book is called No Trade is
No
Free,
trade
or
is
something to that
free.
extent. No Trade is Free, Robert Lighthizer.
So here we are. For the listener, we're recording this on February 4th, so it's the day after. We got a 30-day extension for tariffs, the 25% tariffs on everything except energy. That was going to be 10%, and I can't think of a book that would be more apropos right now. So written by the former U.S. trade representative when NAFTA was being renegotiated into a USMCA or CUSMA, and so the book is No Trade is Free, Changing Course, Taking on China and Helping America's Workers by Robert Lighthizer. What a very, very timely recommendation. All right, Chaz, listen, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to join the podcast. I learned a lot. I really appreciate it.
No, I really appreciate being here. It was That's pretty fun. I thought I was going to bore anyone if I was talking for 47 minutes, Francis, I must admit. So we'll see. I would say you did a pretty good job at
Well, I mean,
measuring this conversation.
I think you've convinced
Almost like
me
you've
that.
done it before.
Well, you've convinced me, and I'm sure you've convinced the listener as well, that I mean, there is a lot going to be taking place in this space, right? Now
Yeah.
and into the future, it's going to be huge.
Electricity is cool, I'm telling you. It's one of those things where you don't think about it, but it's a pretty dynamic, evolving, fun space.
Who knew? All right, awesome. Thanks very much. Appreciate
Yeah.
you taking the time.
Thanks, Francis.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and for those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes, which will include an episode about the Canada-US electricity trade relationship, as I said on the last episode, once we get some clarity about potential tariff actions by the new administration in Washington. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the flux capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 108. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Shaz's recommendation, No Trade is Free, Changing Course, Taking on China, and Helping America's Workers, by former U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.